the University of Montana will get former Senator Max Box's papers and some of his remaining campaign funds. Good evening, I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us why some mountain lion hunters in the Bitterroot want the state to lower the lion quotas. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry looks at a grant program that adds value to Montana agriculture. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the USDA Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment about restoring the national forests. Montana's longest-serving U.S. senator and now America's ambassador to China, Max Baucus, announced today he would donate his official papers to the University of Montana's Archives and Special Collections. What's more, if approved by the State Board of Regents, the Baucus Institute for Public Policy and Service will be established at the UM School of Law. Donna McCray is the head of Archives and Special Collections at UM's Maureen and Mike Mansfield Library. McCray's department is focused on collections of particular historical value and interest to Montanans. She says the Baucus papers certainly fall under that category and will be an important addition to the library's holdings.
He's been in office for 40 years. His work for the state of Montana is represented in the papers. And when I say papers, I mean the legislation, the letters that people wrote to him, memos, the documentation of his activities on behalf of the state of Montana and its people, and as well as on behalf of the whole United States.
McCray says they don't know exactly how many documents and items they'll receive, but they do know it'll be a lot.
We have a good estimate. It's going to be at least 1,000 boxes of material. There are going to be also many, many terabytes of data, of electronic materials. So we will begin by transferring it from the National Archives to the University of Montana, and that will happen sometime this summer. And then we'll begin the process of going through and organizing and sort of making sense of it all so that we can make it available for research in the future.
Baucus will donate $850,000 of his remaining campaign funds to the UM Foundation to cover the cost of archiving his papers.
We will be hiring a political papers archivist to do the work, at least getting us started. There will also probably need to be experts that are brought in to manage some of the electronic materials. We do have a digital archivist at the University of Montana. He'll be doing a lot of the work with the electronic records, but he'll probably need a little bit of help with that. I can't estimate the cost right now because I'm not entirely sure the total size, and I don't know the sort of the organization work that's already been done. I don't think it will be cheap, which is why we're incredibly grateful to Max Baucus for also providing funds that support this work.
UM says the planned Baucus Institute for Public Policy and Service will be nonpartisan and cross-disciplinary and placed at the School of Law. It will be funded through private contributions and include creation of a Baucus Fellows program open to both undergraduate and graduate students, as well as a new lecture series.
And in other news from around the state, Montana wildlife officials are hearing complaints about a new mountain lion study showing lion populations much higher than previously expected in the Bitterroot. Opponents of the study accuse the state of using a faulty method to come to the higher population. They say the lion numbers are much lower and hunting numbers should be lowered. And Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says the most vocal supporters of bringing down the lion hunting quotas are the lion hunters themselves.
I'm Grover Hedrick. I've hunted mountain lions in the state for over 40 years.
He says about 90% of that time was hunting in the Bitterroot Valley or the Blackfoot River drainage.
And I'd like to make a comment on this, on the study numbers there. They're way out of line.
He's talking to the State Fish and Wildlife Commission, which sets hunting quotas. And the study he's talking about comes from a joint effort between Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and the University of Montana. It shows mountain lion populations in the Bitterroot 2 to 4 times higher than previously expected. But Hedrick is one of about a dozen hunters lining up to tell the commission, no, that's wrong.
There's not the cats there.
I hunt almost every day, and they're not there.
I don't agree with these numbers that are reported in this write-up.
That last guy, that's Jason Levine.
I was contracted by the Fish and Game to work on the Bitterroot Lion study.
Levine and others use snowmobiles and hound dogs to track mountain lions for the state study. The opponents think the equations the state used don't make sense for a number of reasons. They say lions killed through hunting were counted in the population estimate. Not enough man-hours searching for lions were accounted for in the process. Basically, Levine believes the population is less than half of what the study estimates.
The folks that hunt lions are really passionate about the resource.
That's the chair of the Fish and Wildlife Commission, Dan Vermillion. The lion hunters don't want too many of the cats taken if they feel it's going to jeopardize the overall population. But Vermillion says there are other Bitterroot hunters.
Who would tell you, you know, what's happened to our deer herd, what's happened to our elk herd? The wolves and the lions are killing too many elk and deer.
A different study from FWP found the majority of elk killed by predators in the Bitterroot were killed by mountain lions, not by wolves as many had previously expected. And elk populations in the Bitterroot are lower than FWP wants them. But Nick Jivak with the Montana Wildlife Federation says that's not because of lions.
The stimulus of this whole issue was an overharvest of cow elk in the mid-2000s.
The state legislature passed a bill which mandated FWP lower the population of elk in the Bitterroot for a while. Remember, normally the Fish and Wildlife Commission sets hunting quotas for elk. Again, Chairman Dan Vermillion.
That was a classic case, in my opinion, of the legislature dictating to the scientists how to manage an elk herd. And, you know, I think we're still trying to clean up from that.
The commission will be looking again at the mountain lion study and how the population conclusions were reached. A working group will be meeting over the next few months to try to decide what mountain lion quotas should be in the Bitterroot area. Right now, they're tentatively set at the same levels as last year. The commission will make their final decision in June. But Commissioner Vermillion says he hopes the passion mountain lion hunters show for the lion populations, he hopes that can be a blueprint for how wolves are perceived one day.
Where you have the guys that are going out and hunt wolves on a regular basis suddenly becoming the fiercest advocates for sound management of wolves.
I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Sure, Montana has cows, but it also has dairies, cheese, and ice cream makers. The same is true for wheat, barley, beer, and liquor. Many of these are small local businesses, but they do create jobs, and encouraging the growth of the value-added agriculture industry in Montana is part of the goal behind the state's Growth Through Agriculture grant program. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more with a recent grant winner on how.
The Kalispell Sweet Peaks ice cream shop is the third one husband and wife team Sam and Marissa Dunhauer opened. The first was in Whitefish in April of 2010, and this Marissa Dunhauer says they're expanding out of the Flathead with a new shop opening in Missoula.
Once we started, we just haven't stopped, and adding new things, employing more people, creating new flavors, it's been really fun. The last couple years have just gone by really quickly. It's a blur.
Yes.
The Blackboard listing specialty flavors includes strawberry cardamom ice cream and dark and stormy. Classics include huckleberry and coffee trader's espresso. Dunhauer says the Missoula opening will have an evening in Missoula sorbet featuring the Montana Tea and Spice Company tea and a Wussner Brothers honey and cinnamon.
Throughout the season, we will get dill from Ten Lake Farms based out of Whitefish and do a lemon dill. We will do, we've done a hibiscus flower and a honey from an apiary in the Flathead. And we've done Flathead cherry chocolate. So we try to use a lot of what Montana has to offer.
Dunhauer says they use Montana milk processed in Great Falls. She says sourcing local is a big part of their business model.
Basically self-taught and, you know, wanted to open a business that would utilize local Montana product, be able to employ people in Montana, be fun, a creative avenue, and we really love ice cream.
It's this connection to Montana-grown products that got Sweet Peaks involved in the Growth Through Agriculture grant program. The business recently won a $15,000 matching grant through the Montana Department of Agriculture. This program will loan funds to a business project that either adds value to Montana agricultural products or creates or keeps jobs in the industry. The state legislature created the program with the goal of strengthening and diverse agriculture in Montana. Other grant winners have included the Flathead Valley Community College, which received an $18,000 grant to develop its multifunctional agriculture program. Kalispell Creamery received a more than $35,000 add yogurt-making capability to its dairy. Montana Native Nursery received a $10,000 grant to help buy the first plants to start a blueberry farm in Plains.
you know, Montana has a lot of products to pull from that, you know, you might not think about, or you might not really consider us being, you know, someplace like California that has abundance of produce all the time. But there's a lot of farmers that are really growing and experimenting things.
Dunhauer says they mix all their ice cream in whitefish, and the grant helps with the costs of expanding distribution to their Flathead stores and also now down to Missoula. She says Sweet Peaks employs about 4 in the summer, about half that in the winter. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
Growing up on the Mescalera Apache Indian Reservation in New Mexico, Arthur Butch Blazer hunted and fished and spent all his time outdoors. He translated that love of the outdoors into a career as a natural resources manager with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, then as the first Native American appointed state forester for New Mexico, and now as the Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and Environment for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, where he oversees the U.S. Forest Service. Blazer is in Missoula this week to meet with local land managers and to speak to tomorrow's meeting of the Society of American Foresters. He also sat down with News Director Sally Mock at the Forest Service Fire Sciences Lab to talk about changes in forest management and policy.
One thing you said in 2012 was that the Forest Service identified nearly half of national forest land, which I think was about 4 acres out of every 10, are in need of restoration. That was in 2012. It's 2014. Has that number gone up or down?
Well, I don't have specific numbers on that. But knowing the outbreaks, continuous outbreaks that we're seeing with our bark beetles and other pests, I would suspect that it is going up. And that just further, again, calls upon all of us, not just the Forest Service, but all of us as forest land managers across the country, to continue to figure out how to work together to address these very important issues.
And when you say all of us, you're really reiterating what Secretary Vilsack said in 2009. He gave a talk then where he talked about it's an all lands approach. It's not just a federal approach or a state approach or a tribal approach or private, that all of those have got to work together. And that's a fairly new focus, isn't it?
Well, it is. But I have to tell you, I reiterate Secretary Vilsack's message time and time again in talks that I give around the country, because our American public truly needs to understand that in order for us to address the forest restoration issues that we have in this country, we've got to do it together. And it's very encouraging since I've been in this business, operating as a state forester in the position that I'm in now, working with state agencies, of course, working with the federal agencies, including the U.S. Forest Service, and then working with our tribes. I'm seeing this collaborative effort grow and get stronger. And it's exactly the direction we need to stay on and really work to, again, inform our national public in regards to the restoration of our forests that has to happen.
There are state and tribal officials across the country who believe that they manage their forests way better than the feds manage theirs, but they have different challenges, don't they?
Most definitely. And, you know, having worked with tribes in my career and having worked on my own reservation, on the Mescalero Apache Reservation in southern New Mexico. You know, we're a timber tribe. But again, in doing the work that we needed to do, we had to have the support of the Mescalero people. That was our public. And as Indian people, they were well informed in regards to the work that needed to be done. And so we gained that support. The various constituencies across the country, state agencies, federal agencies, you know, they have a different public that they have to answer to and involve in their decision-making.
Nationally, there's a lot of debate about forest restoration, whether it's even needed, whether it should be just part of the natural cycle and so on.
That's exactly right. And so that's just another reason that all of us as land managers across the country, we've got to come together, work together to develop that common restoration message that we need to convey to the national public.
What do you say to environmental critics who say restoration is a code word for logging?
You know, they're looking at what has happened in the past. I'm looking as to what's currently happened and what I foresee happening in the future. And again, we learn from past mistakes. We work together to address the interests at hand, you know, habitat interests, economic interests, the viability of our communities. We have to look at this in a very holistic way, and we have to return the balance of management to the forest management of our forested lands in this country.
And that's more than logging.
Oh, definitely more than logging. That commercial piece is very important. But we can't go from one extreme to the other. We've got to look at, again, we've got to look at this in a very holistic, balanced approach, which that's what I'm starting to see come out of these strong collaboratives that are popping up around the country.
Even if you had the funding to do all the things you'd want to do, and that's a big, big if, you're still fighting time, aren't you, in terms of climate change is certainly speeding up, most scientists think. And here you are having restoration needs that are huge that even if you had the funding would take a long time to accomplish. Do you feel like you're fighting that as well?
Well, we definitely are. And again, that's the reason that the Secretary's message of an all-lands approach, which he stated back in 2009, we have to heed that and take it very seriously in looking at developing restoration initiatives and projects that are going to cover large landscapes.
How worried are you, Mr. Blazer, about this upcoming fire season? California is facing possibly horrendous fire season. Your home state, New Mexico, is also very dry. Colorado, Montana, we're not sure yet. We had a pretty good snow season this year, but it could be another devastating fire season, right?
Well, just before I left D.C., I was looking at the fire predictions going into the fire season, and you're exactly right. It's not looking good at all. Much of our western United States are in a very serious drought situation. We're very worried about the fire situation that we're going to have in the western United States.
The president and many members of Congress support the idea of paying for that firefighting differently, of taking the funds out of the natural disaster kitty instead of taking it out of Forest Service funds that would go to restoration or prevention. That would be, I'm sure, something that you think would be a great idea.
Well, I do think it's a good idea. Figuring out how to pay for these large catastrophic fires is something that needs to happen. And the reason for that, if we continue to try and cover these wildfire costs out of our appropriated budgets, out of our existing budgets, that only detracts money away from the non-fire related programs where we're trying to do this restoration work.
It becomes a vicious cycle, doesn't
yes,
it, in some
yes.
ways?
It very much does. And so this new funding strategy that's being discussed will address this and allow us to use more of the money to do the forest restoration work that will help address these catastrophic conditions that we're trying to move away from.
It's going to be an interesting year, isn't it?
It definitely is. And we are working well together, though. We have some great fire agencies out there that work with our federal programs, tribal programs, state agency fire programs.
You're a glass half full kind of guy, Mr. Blazer, aren't you?
I tell you, I started my career fighting fire. I've been in situations where you very quickly gain a strong appreciation for what wildfire can do. And those that are out there and battling these large catastrophic situations, I have great admiration for.
Well, I've been speaking with USDA Deputy Undersecretary for Natural Resources and the Environment, Arthur Butch Blazer. Mr. Blazer, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's just wonderful being back in this area, Missoula. I have a lot of friends up on the Salish Kootenai Reservation, and I just love coming out here. It's just a wonderful part of this country.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with lows in the upper 20s to mid 30s. Tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and highs in the upper 50s to mid 60s. Central Montana tomorrow expect increasing clouds with lows 35 to 40 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and highs 55 to 65 degrees. For southwest Montana tonight, expect partly cloudy skies with lows 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow should be partly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs 55 to 65 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Evan Barrett.
Twenty years ago, Billings, Montana set a national standard for community rejection of hatred and bigotry. Almost as one, the community shouted a loud no to ultra-right-wing extremist behavior that was racist, homophobic, and anti-Semitic. The Northwest United Skinheads and, police believed, elements of the Ku Klux Klan and the Aryan Nation were equal opportunity bigots, targeting for abuse and intimidation anything that wasn't white, American, and Christian. Whether you were black, Latino, Indian, Jewish, or gay, you were not welcome in their America or their Billings. Billings' response was a continuum of courage over many months. Community resistance started with small steps. Initial mainstream reluctance, suggestions that the problem would simply go away if it were ignored, caused community leaders of conscience to stand tall. Billings' resistance to hatred and bigotry eventually culminated in a single act of solidarity that was stunning in its simplicity and its strength. On the night of December 2, 1993, a rock crashed through the bedroom window of 5-year-old Isaac Schnitzer during Hanukkah. A window decorated with the words Happy Hanukkah and a menorah, a dreidel, and a Star of David, all Jewish symbols. Upon some officials advising the Schnitzers to remove the decorations from their windows, Margie McDonald, then executive director of the Montana Association of Churches and now a state legislator, couldn't believe that Billings would allow itself to be intimidated by the extremists. Joined by City Council member Chuck Tooley, Police Chief Wayne Inman, the Ad Hoc Billings Coalition on Human Rights, the Central Labor Council, and many more, including local churches, McDonald pushed an effort to place small paper drawings of menorahs in windows across Billings in a show of solidarity with the Schnitzers. Then Billings Gazette regional editor David Crisp and publisher Wayne Sheely printed in the paper a full-page colored drawing of a menorah with the suggestion that it be hung in windows across the community. Immediately, over 10,000 menorahs sprouted up in homes, proudly proclaiming that Billings stood against the bigoted extremism. What Billings did made me proud as a Montanan, as an American, and as a human being. In Billings at that time, the concept of not in our town was born. From those roots, it grew and sprouted up in many other communities across the country, spawning a national not in our town movement. As the epicenter of the not in our town idea, Billings has secured a positive identity. New York City recognized Billings' leaders like Tooley, McDonald, Sheely, and labor leader Randy Seemers with the city's prestigious Crystal Apple, usually reserved for major national and international political, governmental, or business leaders. Billings is now known across the world for the Not in Our Town story. Former Mayor Tooley says that Billings' Not in Our Town saga is what his town is best known for, noting that the community's response, quote, encapsulates our character, at least the very best part of our character. Now, 20 years later, Billings is the host city for a national Not in Our Town conference to recognize both its past accomplishments and the challenges of extreme bigotry and hatred that still face our nation today and into the future. The fact that Billings was selected for the national conference speaks to its positive Not in Our Town identity, but also to its moral leadership. But that moral leadership is challenged again by a new version of the bigotry and intolerance of the past. When Thule recently approached the city of Billings for financial support for the National Not in Our Town Conference, right-wing religious types came forward, claiming that any city supporter would advance, quote, the homosexual agenda, close quote. At the same time, they railed against the prospective city passage of an anti-discrimination ordinance like those recently passed in Missoula, Helena, and Butte. The city council seemed cowed by the intolerant rhetoric from the right, and to this point has not been willing to invest a single penny in the effort. Shockingly, the Billings Gazette, previously a moral champion of the effort, argued against the city money helping out in the commemorative conference. In expressing more concern for pennies than principle, the Gazette seemed to have forgotten that as the leading communications voice in Billings, it has a responsibility to not just reflect the values of the community, but also, on occasion, to lead the community in the right direction. Can Billings live up to its legacy? Is Billings, through its city government and its leading newspaper, going to allow the continuing bigotry of the right, this time clothed in clerical garments, to tarnish the reputation of the city? Or is it going to stand tall again and proudly proclaim, not in our town, for now and the future? This is Evan Barrett in Butte, thinking proudly of Billings' past reputation and hoping for its future.
Evan Barrett is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition, and the views expressed don't necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow for Montana Morning News.